Want a recipe for success? Step one, visit OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses. Step two, click on my link to browse OCD Training School's amazing course catalog. Step three, enroll. And step four, enjoy learning. With no added cost to you, you can support the OCD family community while grabbing some continuing education or learning how to bridge yourself to self-help strategies for OCD. Again, that's OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses. And use my special link to sign up today.
Hi, fam. It's the inaugural Friday of 2025, and it's wild to me how quickly 2024 flew by. And yet, parts of it, if you're anything like me, fam, were a drag. And we have family old and new joining from all over the world, which is fantastic and exciting because we know OCD affects everyone. So everyone is welcome here. So come on in. Make yourself at home, since some of us literally are at home right now, because today we're reviewing the blueprint for beating OCD that we have in evidence-based therapies, as well as some emerging protocols that have been built on the shoulder of giants and are definitely worth our time and attention. Because even in the midst of pain, struggle, and discomfort, there's still a lot of hope.
I'm Nicole Morris, licensed marriage and family therapist and mental health correspondent. And let me be the first to say, welcome to the family, the OCD family, that is. I am here to create a community of support for family members, spouses, partners, parents, adult children, as there may be adult words, and chosen family of OCD sufferers and their community. I've had over 22 years of experience in the mental health field, but please note that this information does not qualify or substitute as a diagnostic evaluation, therapy, or treatment, and it is presented on an as-is basis. Please follow up with a qualified mental health provider in your area regarding concerns for yourself or loved ones. Thank you for joining us today. Now, let's get started.
Okay, family. Welcome, everyone. Welcome. I'm so grateful to be with you. And today will be a little shorter of an episode. Christmas, Hanukkah, New Year's, and Kwanzaa just wrapped up, and it's been a busy season. And when OCD has been in the picture for either you or your loved one, it can feel like OCD is smothering everyone on top of it all. I saw a meme on social media the other day that essentially said, at a time when everyone's starting to post about everything they've accomplished in 2024 and what they're going to do in 2025, it's okay if all you managed to do was survive. And that resonated with me, fam. It resonated because OCD or OCRDs aside, life throws some curveballs. There are high highs, but there are also low lows. And when we add on, then, the lived experience of OCD, it can feel really, really hard to catch one's breath, leaving folks feeling trapped, isolated, and alone. So I wanted to recap some of what we've learned together over the course of the pod and discuss different treatment options as we turn a new page to 2025. Whether your current page has all the cliffhangers, all the distress, or all the joy and all the peace. Because no matter where you or your family is on that continuum, I guarantee you're not alone. And better yet, there is hope for all of us. So to help me highlight our treatment modalities, including our awesome evidence-based therapies, as well as protocols that are emerging, built upon these research bases, I've pulled some highlights from some of our past amazing guests, and even a bit of a preview for an upcoming episode on the upside of OCD. Because we're better together, right, fam? And to that end, for newer fam joining, just an FYI that all the information and resources highlighted will be linked over on this episode's blog at OCDFamilyPodcast.com. All right, so first off, when we're considering evidence-based therapies, we really need to understand how OCD is functioning. But how we understand OCD to be functioning, furthermore, affects what kind of treatment we're going to do. So I like to consider a two-prong approach. How is OCD functioning and what are we going to do about it? Simple enough, right? No, because the OCD animal is quite an animal with lots of different ways that we could look at it. So how we view the OCD animal is really going to shift our functional strategies on how we treat it. So to start things off, I'm going to throw back to season 1, episode 7 with Dr. John Abramowitz to tell us more about how OCD functions.
So the first thing is for people to understand how OCD works. OCD is a problem where the person with OCD, they have these fears and anxieties about whether it's external situations like I touched the floor or went to the bathroom, or private events like I had a certain thought or a certain feeling of things not being just right. Mm-hmm. And the person with OCD, they feel like they need to fight those experiences. I don't want that anxiety. I don't want that fear. I don't want that uncertainty. And so to them, those experiences are like an urgent matter that requires some sort of action. And so the person does these compulsive rituals, washing, checking. People are probably familiar with those. Mm-hmm. And the point of those rituals is to try to reduce that anxiety, make the feeling of danger go away, try to bring some sort of certainty back and make the person feel safe. The problem is that they end up going to excess and doing this over and over again, and they misperceive danger. They overestimate danger. And when you do compulsive rituals and there's not really danger there, the person never has a chance to learn that they're actually safe to begin with. So that's the experience of OCD for the person who has the problem.
And so with that really helpful overview from John, then, the downstream evidence-based approach we highlight is exposure and response prevention, or ERP. ERP has been around for over 50 years, and here John will explain an overview of ERP as well.
So exposure and response prevention, it is a form of CBT, or cognitive behavior therapy. And what we do in exposure and response prevention is that we challenge folks with OCD to lean into their fears, to face down the situations, the unwanted thoughts, the anxiety, the uncertainty that they typically try to avoid or push away. We want to help them to lean into that so that they can learn that those situations are not as dangerous as they thought. And in most cases, they're not dangerous at all. At the same time, they need to give up their compulsive rituals so that they can also learn, I don't need to do compulsive rituals in order to be safe. The outcomes are generally good. What we know in the literature is that somewhere between 50 and 75% of folks have a positive response. And in most cases, that is a long-lasting response. So that's how therapy works.
Excellent. So ERP is a great option for treatment. And if it sounds hard, that's because it is hard. OCD is hard, for that matter. And this is where working with a trained clinician can be so important. But additionally, I love augmenting ERP through a justice-based lens, which Dr. Caitlin Penciotti et al. Have shared more about, particularly when highlighting OCD themes that impact various intersections. But I think her call to action can and should, which I don't always use the S word, should, apply to ERP across the board. Listen as the good doc shares a bit more.
It's really common when you're first starting in this work as a professional or even as a person with lived experience trying to design exposures for yourself or figure out what you should be challenging yourself with, to go with these surface level fears and try and figure out like what is the most extreme thing that I can do to really increase anxiety. I joke with Marty Franklin because I always quote him when I talk about this, and I feel like I should be paying him royalties at this point, but he describes this as like the fear factor approach. It's easy to slip into this like, okay, how can I get the most bang for my buck? And certainly there are issues with that across the board. That can be such a slippery slope, but it's also not necessary. It's not functional to force ourselves to do these super, super, super extreme things. It's something we should always keep in the back of our mind. Am I helping or am I hurting?
So what Caitlin is speaking to is the importance of targeting core fears underlying the distress in value-driven ways, not in ways that just raise anxiety for anxiety's sake, use other people as props, or perpetuate harmful stigmas. So instead of engaging in those surface-level exposures, we want to target core fears. So one of the examples that Dr. Penciotti and I discussed during her episode, which was Season 1, Episode 29, was surrounding racial slurs. Let's say someone is distressed because they had an intrusive thought about calling someone a racial slur, which is ego-dystonic, meaning it's as far and as opposite from what that person believes or thinks about other people, and they're disgusted by it. Ugh, so many nopes. Listen as she describes what treatment of the core fear is and isn't.
The exposure isn't, let's do that thing and see what you think about it. We don't need people to get used to using horrible slurs. But what you can do is have a conversation with someone and tolerate the uncertainty that maybe it will slip out. Maybe it has slipped out and you didn't realize it. You don't have to actually do the worst case scenario. And in fact, in most cases, I would argue that you shouldn't.
Now, fam, if you're newer to ERP and wondering, but why would you even attempt to tolerate an idea like, what if I'm a racist person? Or what if I'm a dangerous person because I'm secretly racist, even though I abhor racism and I would never want to be racist? Blah. Again, remember what John stated.
We challenge folks with OCD to lean into their fears, to face down the situations, the unwanted thoughts, the anxiety, the uncertainty that they typically try to avoid or push away. At the same time, they need to give up their compulsive rituals so that they can also learn, I don't need to do compulsive rituals in order to be safe.
So the exposure to this core fear and the response prevention is preventing the compulsive or avoidant response. So if you or your loved one finds themselves going round for round, ruminating about whether they're secretly a dangerous racist because they had this distressing, unwanted thought about a racial slur, then a justice-based ERP exposure looks like exposing yourself to the thought that you could be dangerous while practicing the response prevention of not ruminating or arguing with OCD, but like Caitlin shared, tolerating uncertainty. What if this could slip out? Maybe it could, maybe not. It's not about saying slurs 5 times fast, but exposing yourself to the distress that that thought brings and not trying to solve or avoid it. Because the distress isn't dangerous. The distress is a reaction to the thought, and not participating in the compulsions. That's what creates that new learning in the brain that John was talking about. And it's what helps those sticky, intrusive thoughts within OCD become unstuck. And as John noted, it has a positive effect for a lot of people. That being said, it's not a cure. None of these treatments are cures. So options, plural, are important. But as long as we are talking about ERP, I also want to mention a program called SPACE, which I consider to be ERP adjacent. Back in season 1, episode 13, I talked about SPACE with my special guest, Ben Eckstein, and I think he provides a really helpful overview.
SPACE is an acronym for Supportive Parenting for Anxious Childhood Emotions. And it was originally designed to be a treatment for younger children. And sort of the unique thing about SPACE is that those children are actually not involved in treatment. So it's a treatment model where the parents are actually the one receiving treatment. So there are a series of modules that you go through and you essentially learn how to support your child differently. And so in SPACE, they define that as this combination of validation and confidence. So validation being, hey, I know this is really, really hard, but confidence being, and I know you can do it. And so I think just before doing anything with accommodation, learning how to approach those moments where your child is distressed from a different angle, leaning into this sort of different way of supporting them. And then once you've established that, then there is this very systematic approach where you do start removing accommodation behaviors, almost like an exposure hierarchy, right? Like you kind of do this inventory of all the different accommodation behaviors and then select behaviors, not necessarily based on what's the most difficult, but based on what will be the most effective, what makes sense, what will provide the most benefit for the parents or the child. So it doesn't need to be in that hierarchical kind of way, but you just pick these things and there's a whole kind of rollout as to how you pitch that to the kid. And nothing is really expected of the kid. The whole idea here is they can do whatever they want. We're not asking them to do anything. They're not involved in treatment against their will. They don't need to do anything. It's up to the parents to figure out how they approach things differently. And what I think is really fascinating is the results that they've gotten in some of these trials are on par with what kids actually get when they go through ERP themselves. So it's pretty effective. And it is being adapted for older children, specifically more of that kind of failure to launch in your 20s kind of situation.
Okay. So SPACE functions very similarly and shows similar efficacy to someone directly participating in ERP therapy. So this can be a helpful program for parents in particular that want to learn how to create an ERP lifestyle of sorts that ultimately can still benefit the child. Alrighty, so that's ERP. And another common evidence-based practice infused and combined quite a bit with ERP is called ACT, which stands for Acceptance and Commitment Therapy. But ACT can also serve as a standalone treatment, and my podcast brother of a different mother over at the OCD Stories, Stuart Ralph, recently talked with us a bit more in depth about ACT. So let's listen as we review what Stuart had to say.
ACT was huge in terms of really starting to see thoughts as just thoughts, get that diffusion from them, engage in life. I would say ACT was really the game changer for me. The key goal of ACT is psychological flexibility. And Stephen Hayes, one of the founders of ACT, likes to talk about, I think he did in his TED talk, we need to take a break before you have a mental break. And in the context of OCD, the acceptance part of ACT is very much making space for thoughts and feelings, that I'm having these thoughts and feelings. I don't have to agree what the OCD is telling me, of course not, but just that my brain is telling me that the door handle is contaminated or I'm going to hurt some kid, or it's just there's another thought that my brain is giving me. And allowing it to be there. And of course, with OCD, we don't allow it to be there. We're like, get rid of this. I can't think this. Because even if I think it, I'm a bad person. No, you're not. You're just a person with a brain. We get weird, funky thoughts. That's okay.
Right.
So it teaches skills to gradually make space for these thoughts and feelings, allow them to be there, drop the struggle, diffuse, which is get distance from the thoughts and feelings. So meditation, they might call it like becoming the watcher or the observer of your mind. So I do like notice and naming a lot with clients of first you got to notice you're having the intrusive thought, then name it. Oh, there's that worry again. There's OCD again. There's that thought about me harming someone. And that diffusion, that distance can then help. It doesn't get rid of it, but it gets enough of a distance so we don't get hooked and pulled into the OCD. Mm-hmm. And then also there's mindfulness component of ACT, and then it's engaging in committed action to values and something that matters to you.
Yeah.
Which you could call distraction, which it is, but it's distraction in service of living your life and life of meaning and purpose and bringing these thoughts and feelings with you along for the ride. And eventually they'll go.
So again, that was Stuart Ralph from the OCD Stories, a great podcast resource that just rang in 10 years, 10. Way to go, bruh. I mean, a big, big congrats to you, Stuart. And with over 40 years of research, ACT is a great option for treatment. But again, often you'll find many practitioners in the OCD treatment community blending ACT with ERP or inference-based CBT, also known as iCBT, as we're going to talk about next. So iCBT has been around for roughly 30 years and is another highly favored evidence-based practice, which I've said it before and I'll say it again, the treatment world is a little bit like alphabet soup, so we have lots of acronyms out there. But fam, I definitely try to break down that soup into tangible bites because I know you and your loved ones have enough on your plates, bowls, as it is. And if you're newer to the OCD treatment world, you might be surprised to learn that iCBT, or even ACT for that matter, is so established. But all the more reason for review sessions like this, so we can learn what's available out there, and so you and your loved one can choose what might be the best fit for you, or try alternatives if you're reaching stuck points in your current treatment. So how does OCD function from an iCBT perspective? Well, who better to ask than the co-founder of iCBT, Dr. Frederick Ardema. So let's hear about this upstream understanding of OCD from the man and co-creator himself.
Something else is going on in OCD, according to the first-place post, something very different, which is that a person creates a story that makes these possibilities into a relevant consideration in the here and now. Mm-hmm. And that is done by reaching a probability, let's say. Mm-hmm. So that's the distinction between abstract possibility and real probability. And that is done by reasoning. And this reasoning is characterized, that we go back to, this distrust of the senses, a distrust of the self, an over-reliance on the imagination, which causes imagination to be superimposed on reality. It leads to a confusion between reality and possibility. And suddenly, what should just maintain, or what should just be an abstract possibility with no emotional relevance, with no intensity to it, just abstract like any other possibility that the shadow word brush aside is no relevant. That's what causes this enormous intensity. It creates this enormous absorption, which should be just an abstract possibility, into something that becomes very real to the person in the here and now. In that sense, acting upon compulsions is the most natural thing in the world you can do. It was a real probability. You know? Mm-hmm. There is a real danger, no matter how small, mm-hmm. actually relevant to the here and now.
Right.
Children may be in danger. that my loved ones may be in danger. It's a natural instinct to act upon. The problem is that you're acting on what is no more than an abstract possibility. The thought should not even come up. It's not a matter of accepting your thought, not a matter of accepting uncertainty. Thought should not even be there. It's not relevant to the UML. Problem is, you make it relevant through a story that you tell yourself. Stories themselves are not wrong, but how the person with OCD applies to it in the here and now is problematic. It leads to an actual obsession. That's the issue. That's the crux of what we call inference confusion.
Okay, fam. So if you're newer to ICBT, you might be going, what now? Because this way of both conceptualizing and treating OCD is very, very different. So let's first invest a little bit of time on understanding inferential confusion a bit better, which is the mechanism for how OCD works that we learn about in ICBT. And then we'll talk a bit more about treatment. I've had a number of guests on over the years that have talked about inferential confusion, but I'm going to highlight just a few voices on the subject, starting with Mike Hetty, who was the first to come on this podcast and really helped me and the fam understand this concept better.
If we arrive at a conclusion to doubt, inference of doubt, through this reasoning narrative, we begin to distrust what reality is telling us. We begin to distrust what our five senses and our common sense tell us. We begin to distrust what we know about this present moment. And we start to favor what could be. We start to favor and trust and overinvest in what hypothetically might be, or otherwise trust our imagination, right? So that's actually the definition of inferential confusion, which is the primary process that not only predicts for OCD, but if we treat it and reduce its intensity, people get better from OCD.
To illustrate this point further, let's listen to our most recent podcast guest, Carl Robbins, share more about what this looks like conceptually.
What do we mean by confused? What we mean is having trouble telling the difference. You know, my wife has two nephews that are close in age and very similar, and I call Jack Pete and Pete Jack, so I confuse them, right? I have trouble telling them apart. And that's what inferential confusion is. And there's something called the inferential confusion questionnaire, which shows that people with OCD have a tendency, more than people who don't have OCD, to get confused in this way.
So if you or someone in your life is dealing with OCD, it can feel like this inferential confusion is pretty widespread. And we can measure it, as Carl stated. But actually, the area in which folks with lived experience deal with inferential confusion is a rather small slice of their processing at large. Let's listen as OCD psychiatrist Dr. Ryan Vidrine shares more.
Most of us were trained around ERP of like OCD is a problem with uncertainty and we have to embrace uncertainty. And I like the framing through ICBT of it's not necessarily the problem. Patients with OCD deal with uncertainty quite well in a whole variety of contexts all day long, arguably 90%+ of their life. It's only specific to these few areas that they happen to be sensitized to in these domains or themes or whatnot, right? I think ICBT is really good at specifying it's this doubt in trusting yourself and this doubt in knowing who you are. Mm-hmm. And that actually we have as much certainty as we have about everything else we do without question. You have the information you need. In the here and now, you actually know who you are. You just need to remember that and trust that.
So Ryan was speaking to the point that we can have some functional relative certainty in life, OCD or not, that we derive day in and day out through our internal sense data, common sense, and our ability to read a room with direct evidence. So the problem is a doubt, which we've constructed, which has this narrative or a story that leads to these confused conclusions or inferential confusion. But for a lot of people newer to learning about ICBT, what comprises a doubt? Because in ICBT, doubts are differentiated from intrusive thoughts, as we've learned about in ERP. Listen as my friend and fellow OCD podcaster, Christina Orlova, the OCD Whisperer, expands on this a bit more.
Doubt is what? Doubt is when I actually do have information in front of me, but I'm not trusting it. I'm doubting it. I'm doubting what I'm seeing. I'm doubting what I'm feeling. I'm doubting what I'm hearing. But the information's there. Uncertainty is I may not even have information, or I may not even be able to get information. So we all know we all have uncertainties that we have to live with, right? But here, it's a different target. It's not about uncertainty. It's about resolving this doubt that's pathological. Obsessive doubt. It's understanding and identifying where is it that I am now, I was in reality and I was operating was functioning. I was certain of things. I was trusting things. I was moving on with life. And then suddenly something happened. And instead of being in that place, I'm getting teleported somewhere else. And now I'm doubting everything about myself, everything about what I'm perceiving, right? And now I'm getting absorbed in this OCD bubble, as we say in ICBT. That's really a key ingredient, right? Because when we can resolve that obsessional doubt, when we can help you start to see it, when is it that you're starting to depart from reality into some other place and have you come back, then you can start to re-engage with your life in that way that you typically do, like anybody else does, right? Like anybody else.
I like how Christina describes that, teleporting into the imagination. We also can call that a crossover point in the ICBT world. And I love how my colleague and ICBT trainer, Bronwyn Schroyer, succinctly explains it.
I'm doing my crossover point from reality into the imagination, and I don't need to go into my imagination. All the evidence I need is right here in front of me.
So as you can likely hear, ICBT functions very differently from ERP. And to that end, treatment looks very different, as Dr. Jeremy Schumann and Catherine Goldhouse note well.
ICBT offers a non-exposure method of treating OCD by directly going after inferential confusion and going after doubt.
The goal of ICBT is for clients to learn to trust themselves and stay connected to reality rather than getting lost in the world of what if. So treatment focuses essentially on the thinking process that leads people to continue doubting something, even when they have all the information they need.
So ICBT treatment follows the structure of 12 modules that explore how doubts are constructed, understanding inferential confusion, relearning to trust our real selves, and strategies for getting out of the OCD bubble. And like Jeremy mentioned, it's a non-exposure-based model, which is no shade to ERP. It's simply approaching the OCD animal from a different vantage point. But for folks going, golly, I am too scared to approach anything with exposure in the title, or for that 25 to 50% John quoted where OCD doesn't improve, it's good to know more treatments exist. So again, check out this episode's blog over at OCDFamilyPodcast.com to learn more about any of the therapies I'm mentioning today, because I'm going to have those links for you, whether you're interested in learning more about ERP, ACT, ICBT, you name it. And speaking of understanding OCD from a different purview, let's zoom out from CBT altogether. Again, that's cognitive behavioral therapy. And let's switch gears to learn more about metacognitive therapy, or MCT, another nearly 30-year-old treatment. In season 3, episode 111, Dr. Pia Callison shared more about her work with the co-founder of OCD Training School, Bronwyn Schroyer, and me here on the pod. In fact, Pia will be giving a live training in February of 2025, practically weeks away at this point, through OCD Training School. And MCT looks at the OCD animal from quite a different lens from CBT. But what's also really cool about MCT is it's a transdiagnostic approach, which means it works for more than just OCD. So that's pretty handy and helpful as we think about OCD, depression, anxiety, even trauma. Listen to how Pia explained MCT to us when we chatted with her a few months ago.
MCT is based on a lot of years of research, actually, because Adrian Wells was really puzzled about the cognitive model. He didn't think it fit because he thought, I have a lot of negative thoughts and I'm not depressed. Something doesn't fit here. And that started 30 years of research. And he also made a book, Attention and Emotion, from 1996. Where he published all these research that he's done. And he wanted to find out what is the main difference between the people who get OCD, depression, and anxiety, and the people who don't. Is it their age? Is it their gender? Is it how many traumas they have in their backpack of the life experience? What is the main difference between these two groups? And after 30 years of a lot of research, he realized it was actually how we handle our thoughts. So the most important factor, or most important difference, was the time we spend handling our thoughts. He also calls it the cognitive attentional syndrome.
And fam, I'm still learning about MCT, but I'll have that episode linked on the blog if you want to learn more about it. And I can't wait to hear more about it when I attend the live training in February. So if you're hearing this episode hot off the press and want to look into attending too, there is still time to sign up. In fact, as an affiliate with OCD Training School, you can visit ocdfamilypodcast.com/courses and sign up for this training via my special link, which helps to support this podcast at no extra cost to you. But if you're catching this post-February, I'm still going to encourage you to check out OCD Training School's course catalog, because while I'm not a fortune teller, I would be surprised if there was an on-demand training added at some point on MCT, because if I've learned anything about the amazing resources at OCD Training School, it's that we have choices in treatment, and it's worth knowing about all the options available to us, fam. Okay, so we've discussed a couple different types of CBT in ERP, ACT, and ICBT, but I also want to do a shout out for medication support and pharmacotherapy. Recently, the fam got to hear from another OCD psychiatrist in our field, Dr. Stacy Greeter, and I loved what she had to say on the subject. Because when we start talking about medication, I think it can make people feel a bit nervous. So let's hear her perspective on it.
I think that something to keep in mind is that when you go to see a psychiatrist, you are going to get information from them to help you make, hopefully, a values-based rather than fear-based choice regarding medication, and that's up to you. Just simply seeing a psychiatrist doesn't mean you have to be completely sold on medication. You're there getting almost like a consultation to get info. So keeping in mind, the autonomy is always on parent or patient about the decision to take medicine. And then my role as a psychiatrist is to give you a real good in-depth overview of the pros and the cons. The vast majority of people live more fulfilling lives on medicine for OCD. It does really help people do the work of therapy. It really is kind of like a lubricant for the hard work of therapy.
Right.
And can decrease that level of crisis point anxiety to the point that it is manageable enough to really face the exposures that are required of OCD. OCD treatment, powerful and effective, but really, really, really hard.
Very hard, yeah.
We ask our patients very challenging things. We ask a lot of someone's courage. We ask them to try a new medicine, and when we ask them to do exposure therapy. So I'm encouraging people to try all the resources at their disposal. And if a medicine doesn't work for them, they can always stop it. I say, you're dating the medicine, not marrying it.
I love that. You're just dating. Now, I know she mentioned how helpful medication can be with exposure therapy. Again, that's our ERP work. But I wanted to mention medication can also be helpful across any of these treatments that we are talking about today. In fact, when I asked Stacy how she even ended up learning more and specializing with OCD in her psychiatric work, she mentioned the following.
So I had people talking about ICBT and how cool it was, and I wanted to learn ICBT.
I mean, that's pretty cool, right? And Stacy's story is awesome. As an ADHD psychiatrist with lived experience of OCD as well, she has insight and great compassion for a number of intersections. And she also makes learning engaging and fun through her YouTube channel, presentations, and shared work like she did on this podcast. So again, you know where the links will be. Hit up OCDFamilyPodcast.com. So what kind of medication is right for OCD? What's the first line treatment? Let's hear from the doc herself.
Selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors are first line. It'll be complicated if you have bipolar disorder. Additionally, then SSRIs will not be first line, for example. And then we're usually, you know, the very key point is that the regular dosages that people use for treating major depressive disorder or generalized anxiety disorder are much lower than the dosages that are needed to treat OCD. And correcting a lot of common misconceptions, the medicine's not addictive. A lot of people are able to come off the medicine. That actually, if you treat more fully to remission, then you have a better chance of coming off the medicine versus staying on a lower dose and a partial treatment of your OCD.
Okay, so this is not medical advice, just like it's not therapy. And just because regular doses for OCD are often higher than those for anxiety or depression, everyone's body handles medications differently. So if you're considering or currently on a medication, please follow up with your doctor about any questions, concerns, or treatment recommendations. We all know users on Reddit or Tumblr or Instagram might have had this experience or that, but that really only tells you about their alleged experience on this or that. The only person you or your loved one should weigh the words heavily of is your own and your doctor's, who understands your body and the confluence of your individualized healthcare needs. But I also wanted to mention that there are other therapies being facilitated by psychiatrists to help manage and support treatment and recovery. And currently, research has been focusing on clinical trials with psychedelics, which for some people, you're like, nope, nope, that's a no, no. And for others, you're like, but when? I was ready for that treatment yesterday. So let's revisit with Dr. Ryan Vidrine once more to understand what that potential treatment could even mean and what's being studied for the treatment of OCD and other mental health disorders.
People sometimes use the term a little more broadly or specifically in terms of things like really classical psychedelics like psilocybin mushrooms or LSD, things like ayahuasca, versus MDMA or colloquially Molly, right? Yeah. To see. Is not technically typically a classic psychedelic, but often can be very impactful, meaningful, have psychedelic-like experiences. And then ketamine is now the one that is kind of most widely accessible currently and legal. And again, it is a dissociative agent. It's used as an anesthetic at higher doses, has been around for a very long time, is not classically a psychedelic, but has clearly in some people elicited really impactful, meaningful, altered states of consciousness that can be sort of parapsychedelic or psychedelic light, if you will. So those are kind of a lot of the substances that people are looking at. Ketamine is the only one that's legal right now and commercially available. Psilocybin and MDMA are both in multiple studies and are likely to probably get an FDA approval within the next year or two. Most, if not all of these studies, I should say, are typically higher dose sessions as trained professional as a guide or therapist and include preparatory work and integration work after the fact. So this is not like pop a psychedelic and go about your business.
See if your life's better.
It's mostly not microdosing, although there's a little bit there and maybe that will come, but like most of the studies and where the likely approvals will happen is not in microdosing. So that's where we have most of our kind of research evidence currently is on these preparative therapy sessions with a high dose with a professional and then integration sessions go over what you experienced and make meaning of it and how do you want to carry it with you.
Okay, so a lot of these trials are looking at disorders like depression, trauma, and the outcomes for OCD specifically are still pretty scarce, but they are being done and people do want to know more about it. So I included it here. Ryan also talks a little about deep brain stimulation and TMS briefly, which is actually what brought him into the OCD and psychiatry sphere in the first place.
I think if you look at some of these novel treatments, deep brain stimulation, TMS, some of these things, OCD is one of the disorders that is one of the only things that it has approvals for. And so in certain ways, it's a little bit ahead of the curve.
Now, a few things here. Deep brain stimulation and TMS are different. TMS stands for transcranial magnetic stimulation, and it's an outpatient procedure, sometimes referred to as the depression helmet, and it has transdiagnostic efficacy for OCD and other mental health disorders. It's non-invasive and generally pretty effective. Now, when it comes to DBS or deep brain stimulation, I know it gets confusing because there's TMS and then there's DBS. I recognize that just even the sound of it, deep brain stimulation, sounds pretty scary, and it often gets confused with something like electroshock therapy. But fam, it's not electroshock therapy. Listen as OCD researcher Dr. Eric Storch talks more about what DBS is and what research has shown when it comes to OCD.
So deep brain stimulation is a neurosurgical treatment that's safe, rarely used with adults with refractory OCD. These are folks that have tried everything, you know, dozens and dozens and dozens of hours of ERP, three or four antidepressants, you know, together with antipsychotics. Like, I mean, you have had to fail a lot of treatment before that's even considered. And you know what? It works really well, like really well.
Okay, so a couple important things there. Eric referenced refractory OCD, which is another way of saying treatment resistant. So whether doing therapy or medication or both, if OCD is not budging. DBS is an evidence-based treatment that can deliver continuous stimulation versus something like electric shock therapy, where electrodes are attached to one's scalp and essentially induce a seizure in a patient. You see, those are two incredibly different procedures. And like Eric mentioned, DBS is not a first-line treatment, mainly due to it being a neurosurgical procedure, which is a lot more invasive than the other treatments we've mentioned. DBS can work really well for OCD, though, and for other medical conditions or neurological disorders like Parkinson's disease, for example. And so it's great to have an option if OCD is not budging. But for the vast majority of lived experience warriors, it never gets to the point of considering DBS. But if you or a loved one has, I'm glad that it's there, I'm glad it's research-based, and I'm glad this neurosurgical option is proven to show relief for OCD. You deserve that. Okay, so we've summarized some amazing evidence-based therapies that are out there for OCD, and I will note some incorporation of more generalized CBT or even dialectical behavioral therapy, also known as DBT, can be helpful as well, but I would always, always recommend they be used in conjunction with our other established evidence-based practices. Now, with ERP being our oldest treatment on the block and recognizing that our ERP of today has evolved a long way from where it started, I think it's important to highlight emerging treatments that are a buzz in our treatment community. For many of these emerging approaches or protocols are built on the shoulders of giants, from a firm foundation of what we know about OCD from decades of the research and existing therapies. So I'm going to mention my top four emerging treatment interests here, starting with a known evidence-based treatment that will sound particularly familiar from the top of the show, and that's ICBT, but this time for kids. So ICBT has a robust and growing research base, and we thoroughly covered the importance of targeting and reducing inferential confusion earlier in this episode. But based on a whole host of variables for kiddos, something that's covered in most Psychology 101 courses, is a dude by the name of Jean Piaget and his theory of cognitive development. So how we reason from even a pre-operational phase to a more concrete to even further yet, a more formal or abstract stage will impact how we reason our growing world. Thusly, not all age ranges will benefit from ICBT. But as a number of us providers have found, once a kiddo can distinguish between reality and imagination, often they can do very well with ICBT treatment strategies. So part of what emerging treatment requires is a curiosity that states, hey, if we know this treatment to be helpful here, we have this clinical understanding of how it helps, and we know that this kiddo is capable of distinguishing reality from imagination, then this might be a really important field of study that can expand this evidence-based treatment modality's reach. So while fidelity to our models is so super important, it's also how we've learned in other areas, like with DBS, that it can be helpful for more than just Parkinson's, or that SSRIs can be helpful for more than just depression. And being judiciously curious and researching our growing hypotheses are so very important. So that's number one. And number two, a very popular topic here on the pod, has been a protocol called rumination-focused ERP, or RF-ERP for short. This protocol, again built on the shoulder of giants within the ERP world, integrates exposure and response prevention with a psychodynamic approach. Additionally, as the name suggests, it focuses on rumination, and even more so, how rumination is controllable. Listen to the creator of this protocol, Dr. Michael Greenberg, explain it more.
I had this realization that rumination was analytical thinking. Yeah. In other words, this realization that rumination was not a thought over and over and over again. It was you trying to figure something out. And the key thing is that analytical thinking is controllable, and therefore rumination is controllable. In other words, people think that rumination is something that happens to them. And the key take home of RFERP is recognizing that rumination is actually something that you are doing. There are emotional factors that make you feel compelled to do it. You might not realize that you have a choice about doing it, but ultimately it is something that is subject to your control. And if you're ruminating, you can actually stop.
Are you intrigued? You're not alone. I get a lot of hits on this episode and lots of comments over on YouTube. It is very intriguing. And in season 2, episode 90, we discuss all of this and more. But since both this protocol and traditional ERP involve, well, ERP, you might be curious about how this ERP bit differs, if at all. Again, I highly recommend listening to the episode, but here is a morsel of clarity to help you along the way.
The key difference is traditional ERP is trying to raise anxiety to maximize anxiety during exposure, and RF ERP is trying to minimize anxiety during an exposure, not just because we're trying to be nice, but because in our book, anxiety is an indicator of compulsion. Anxiety is an indicator of rumination, of mental engagement. And so we're trying to minimize it because that's an indicator that there's no compulsion.
Okay, so the role of anxiety is uniquely different in RF ERP. But also, as I mentioned before, RF ERP also integrates this version of ERP that Michael just shared about with psychodynamic work. So what does that mean exactly? Well, let's take a listen.
OCD is an emotional disorder. It comes from somewhere. It's about emotional conflict. It develops in the context of emotional and relational experiences. And just addressing it on a behavioral level, it's like if you have a sailboat on the water, if the sea gets rocky, like CBT is adjusting the sails to figure out how to manage your boat on those rocky waters. And that's tremendously important. But then the psychodynamic piece is looking at what is making these waters so rocky. Where is all of this turbulence coming from?
And fam, there are a lot more facets to RF-ERP, but again, it's not its own evidence-based practice, though it is built on the foundation of so much research. So I'm going to link Michael's website, which is chock-full of resources for RF-ERP. Alrighty, so that brings us to number 3, which is the mastery approach. The mastery approach was created by my friend and colleague Rich Gallagher, LMFT. And Rich's work is also built upon the research and findings from traditional ERP and ACT, but there are some very functional differences in his approach. Additionally, when we talk about OCD, we often reference fear as a primary form of distress experience, though it's not the only sort of distress our warriors have. But Rich's work has expanded on not only fear-based OCD presentations, but also disgust and sensory-based distress as well. And this is important because when we think of a common theme like contamination OCD, what research has shown us is fear and disgust are processed in different areas of the brain. Thusly, when treating disgust-based OCD, research has also shown that traditional ERP isn't super effective. Now, while I will say understanding the cognitive piece through a treatment like ICBT can be helpful when it comes to disgust, I've been duly impressed by how Rich's mastery approach has been a game changer for my OCD clients struggling with this presentation. So while I'll note that the mastery approach can be helpful for more than just disgust, I am pretty excited that it includes disgust. Because honestly, we needed more hope and more progress in our disgust protocols. Listen to Rich as he shares more.
What I found with my themes, which I learned were really disgust and not just pure contamination, what I discovered was that I would do exposures. I would actually habituate to the anxiety. I would do something. I would touch something yucky. I would sit with it. I wouldn't distract myself. I would hit that extinction burst that we talk about where your anxiety goes down after a period. But my sense of disgust would get nothing but worse. I'd be cross-contaminating everything in my life, and I'd feel even more and more closed in. Eventually, I ended up traumatized and housebound from that treatment. It was a horrible experience. It was a very dark place, and I was there for almost 2 years. But thankfully, in my case, the story didn't end there. Thankfully, I eventually hooked up with a fantastic clinician. Her name was Dr. Katrina Blomquist. For the first time, she really listened to what was working and not working for me. And so our therapy sessions were really brainstorming sessions. Neither of us knew our way out of the jungle yet. And we spent months literally jiggling the key in the lock, trying different strategies. And so eventually we found an approach almost by accident that worked for me and later turned out to have emerging literature support behind it. And I eventually disseminated this as a proposed treatment protocol for disgust-based OCD. And it just changed everything about my life. And I recovered very quickly once I discovered what to do.
So what does it entail? Well, it entails a lot. But a core feature of the mastery approach is it allows for the use of some judicious safety behaviors to help move you towards practicing and mastering the life you want. And while you might say, hey, but isn't that accommodation? Isn't accommodation reinforcing OCD? Isn't that not response prevention? Well, kind of. And that and is pretty important, fam. This isn't ERP, but in a lot of ways, you can still practice helpful response prevention. So the mastery approach helps you build attainable goals, values readiness, and moves you toward engagement with life with the support of lower cost, bigger gain, judicious safety behaviors. Or listen, as Rich states it.
The idea that I could absolve myself of using reasonable, judicious safety behaviors versus the ERP model that I have to get used to this somehow, and that I could make reasonable accommodations and get used to living life, changed my life.
So if you're curious where you can learn more about the mastery approach, Rich recently published the Contamination OCD Workbook that helps walk folks through building their own mastery approach to OCD treatment. And it's a phenomenal resource. I've used it with multiple clients, including for contamination and emetophobia. And I learned Rich even gave the OCD Family Podcast a shout out in his book, which was very kind of him. But that's not why I'm telling you about it, fam. And I get no kickback from endorsing it other than knowing you and your loved ones have access to more hope. So check out his episode here with the fam or grab a copy of the Contamination OCD Workbook. All the links are going to be provided on this episode's blog at OCDFamilyPodcast.com. All right, now last but not least is a very new approach to me that felt worth including. And it's a bit of a preview, fam, because I'm talking about the upside of OCD with Dr. Michael Alsey. And I'm even debating, am I pronouncing that correctly? Mike, my apologies if not. But this content is going to be featured in its own full-length episode in just a few short weeks here on the pod. And Mike recently published a book on the upside, and I found our conversation to be compelling. So let's take a listen.
So speaking to those of you who have watched people struggle and suffer from OCD, I wanted to write more to the heart of the person who has OCD. What's going on inside for them emotionally? What kind of deep sensitivity do they have that people often miss? What kind of creativity do they show that people only see when it's tormenting them? So I really wanted to show more of the person as well as the disorder. But my kind of new angle is that I think the person who has these qualities develops OCD. And I think we tend to focus when the disorder is already flourished and forget about these really interesting, kind of beautiful characteristics of a person who will later develop OCD. And so to me, I wanted to reclaim this heart. Because I think people with OCD actually have an enormous heart. Like if the Grinch has like a heart that's like way too small, a person with OCD has a heart that's way too big. And it's often so big for others and not big enough for the self.
Right.
And so even if you think about cognitive behavioral therapy, does a wonderful job of focusing on how these thought spirals happen and how we can kind of interrupt them and disrupt them and move beyond them. But it doesn't talk enough about the heart and the emotions. It often talks about emotions as resulting from getting in check with that. But I just wanted to come from the heart first.
All right. Interesting, right? Mm-hmm. And if you like what you hear, make sure to keep an ear out for his episode later this month. Or better yet, pick up your own copy of The Upside of OCD and learn what all the buzz is about. Okay, fam, we have covered a lot of ground here. But if that tells us one thing, that tells us a lot about the evidence-based treatments and emerging protocols worth their weight in salt. And that's great news, fam, because with more options, there's more hope. But let me clarify, that doesn't mean all treatments help with OCD, not even all evidence-based treatments, because ultimately we have to rely on the proof that these treatments actually help for OCD. So for example, EMDR, it's an evidence-based treatment. Sometimes you'll hear it advertised for treating OCD, but it is not indicated for OCD. It is a great treatment for trauma, along with prolonged exposure and a number of other evidence-based trauma treatments. But we treat trauma and OCT differently. So EMDR for OCD? Nope. That's a pass. There are also other trends like brain spotting, and it feels like a lot of people are getting trained in brain spotting. So there's some general excitement in the broader mental health treatment community about brain spotting. But the reality is it lacks quality evidence regarding efficacy or effectiveness for OCD. Yeah, the brain spotters are going to come for me on that. But you know what? Even if people self-report benefits from their experience of something like brain spotting with OCD, I need more than that. And you know why? Because I have OCD. My son has OCD. My extended family has OCD. I have friends that have OCD. I have clients that have OCD. And either you or your loved ones, you may have OCD. And we deserve better than some positive self-reports from the peanut gallery. And the research has shown it's not the secret sauce. So we need to be creative and open-minded, absolutely, like we talked about with the four different protocols that we just reviewed. But we still need to require that strong foundation of research and knowledge that we can trust. So hopefully this review has been helpful for you, fam. Whether you've been with us for a hot minute or are brand spanking new to our family, just trying to stay above water. The truth is OCD sucks. OCD is hard, but hope is available in so many different forms. And above that, fam, knowing we aren't alone, knowing we will continue to learn and grow and fight this OCD animal, that is very, very good news. So happy New Year, fam. And remember, we've got this.
Thank you for joining me and our OCD family community. If you enjoyed what you heard today, please like and subscribe to the OCD Family Podcast wherever you enjoy your podcasts. Did you find this content helpful? Please consider leaving a review. The more people that know they're not alone, the better. For more information regarding today's podcast, please visit OCDFamilyPodcast.com and remember to join the email list while you're there. It will provide you with the most up-to-date information, resources, and the download on the family chatter. Oh yeah, nothing says family like kicking OCD right in the booty. That's right, I went there. And you can too at OCDFamilyPodcast.com.
Therapists, ready to shape the future of pediatric OCD treatment? Join the Next Steps in Pediatric OCD on-demand course from Angela Adamson Springer, LCSW, and learn how to adapt inference-based cognitive behavioral therapy for kids. With research still emerging, this course empowers you to explore new methods and contribute to the growing field of evidence-based practices. With OCD Training School's 365-day access for on-demand courses, you'll gain practical tools to help kids by adapting ICBT's signature 12 modules to be as creative as the kiddos you're treating. So sign up at OCDFamilyPodcast.com/courses to support the podcast at no extra cost and support further growth and hope for our youngest of warriors.